Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict prays for the victims of the devastating earthquake in China and says he hopes solidarity will be shown towards those affected by this new disaster. Malta awaits. We look ahead to the Pope's visit to Malta this weekend and speak to the head of the Catholic Church there and the director of the local Jesuit refugee service about the mood ahead of this papal visit and examine the trip's main themes. And learning from the past. We talked to the head of the National Catholic Safeguarding Commission in England and Wales, who gives us the lowdown about the policies and procedures adopted in recent years to safeguard children and vulnerable adults within the Church. In the Vatican, Pope Benedict says he is praying for the victims of the devastating earthquake in China and hopes solidarity will be shown towards those affected by this new disaster. The Pope's words came in an appeal at the end of his Wednesday General Audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Comincio con un appello. Il mio pensiero va alla Cina.
An earthquake measuring 7.1 hit the area of Qinghai, southwest China, high on the Tibetan plateau this morning, killing hundreds of people and injuring thousands more. Many others are still trapped under the rubble of collapsed houses. Speaking in Italian at the end of his general audience, Pope Benedict said, "My thoughts go to China and the people affected by the strong earthquake that caused heavy losses in lives, injuries and extensive damage." He said, "I pray for the victims and I am spiritually close to those who are suffering from such severe disasters. I implore God for relief of suffering and courage in these adversities. I hope that common solidarity will not fail."
Auspico che non verrà a mancare la comune solidarietà.
Earlier in his address to the 20,000 people who had gathered in St. Peter's Square this Wednesday, Pope Benedict reflected on the role of the priest as the year specially dedicated to the ordained ministry draws to a close.
I wish to speak in particular of the priest's configuration to Christ, the head of the Church, so the exercise of the three munera of teaching, sanctifying and governing. In the ministry, priests act in persona Christi, in the person of Christ. The three munera are in fact actions of the risen Christ, who even today through his priests continues to teach, sanctify and govern his Church. The first of the three munera is set of teaching, so important for our times.
Pope Benedict continued, "The priest is called to preach and to teach not himself but Jesus Christ and his revelation of the Father."
This teaching, far from an abstract doctrine, is a living proclamation of the person of Christ, who is himself truth, the source of our joy, peace and spiritual rebirth. The priest Monstocini demands that his whole life testify to the truth of the message that he proclaims in harmony with the apostolic tradition and often in opposition to the spirit of the dominant culture.
Following the example of the great Cure of Ars, Pope Benedict concluded with the prayer that every priest proclaim Christ faithfully and speak in such a way that all can hear him in the voice of the Good Shepherd.
Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Us hat Leid vor illem Montagnin.
Pope Benedict will make a pastoral visit to Malta this weekend to mark the 1950th anniversary of when the Apostle St. Paul was shipwrecked on the island. The Pope's 24-hour trip to Malta will be the third papal visit to this Mediterranean island, following visits there by Pope John Paul in 1990 and 2001. The head of the Catholic Church in Malta is Archbishop Paul Cremona, and he spoke to us about this weekend's papal visit. Malta's population is nearly 98% Catholic, and Archbishop Cremona began by telling us how the apostle found fertile ground in Malta for the spread of the gospel message during his three-month stay on the island.
You know that we have invited the Pope this year because we are celebrating the 1950th anniversary of St. Paul's shipwreck on the island. In Malta, we consider this as a providential shipwreck, because according to the Acts, Paul did not want to leave where he was sheltering, but it was the captain who wanted. St. Paul would not have chosen a small island, which nobody knew about, to preach. He would search for Corinth or Rome or Ephesus, but certainly not the small island. So we consider it as a gift from divine providence that he came over. It seems that St. Luke and even Paul were really astonished, pleasurably astonished, because they found that on this island there were people who, although as they are called Barbaroi, because they were not polished culturally, they immediately accepted this shipwreck. They didn't know who Paul was, so it was their great hospitality, which he didn't find obviously in other places. And the second thing is that he found in them already a great sense of the divine, because they interpreted the miracle of the viper, which we find in the Acts of the Apostles, and they interpreted before, when he was bitten and after he did not fall dead, in terms of the divine. So I think these two things helped so that the islanders would be prepared to hear Paul's preaching. At the end of the 3 months that he stayed over here, when he was going away from the island, we interpret what happened, that crowd of Maltese who were sending him off and giving him all the provisions that he needed, we say that there was a change. Now it was a new Christian community that was seeing Paul off from the island.
Indeed, Paul is known as the apostle to the Gentiles, the great evangelizer of the Christian faith. And this seems to be an inheritance that the Maltese church has taken very seriously indeed, from this tiny island in the Mediterranean with a great and long tradition of seafaring. You've become a very, very missionary church. In fact, the first appointment with the Pope has with the Church of Malta, as you pointed out, the special guests are the missionaries, the priests, nuns and lay missionaries that the Maltese Church has provided to the Universal Church. How do you explain this?
Well, I think there was a great sense of, you know, sharing one's faith. And I think even the bishops on the island, all throughout, I think especially during the last 2-3 centuries, and they went everywhere. They are in the 5 continents, all of them in different places. And since there was a good number of vocations, especially at that time for the priestly and the religious, female and male, on the island, I think that the church in Malta wanted to share this great gift of divine providence with other churches which needed other personnel, so that these new churches would really come to life and become strong. Thank God, in the last, let's say, decades, we have also had many lay missionaries going abroad, some even with families, to evangelize other places. So that is a great gift that the Lord has given us, and the church in Malta has sought to share this great gift with other places where they needed this kind of help.
From a church, from a missionary church, an evangelizing church, from a country of emigration, you have in recent years become a country that is increasingly witnessing the phenomenon of immigration. We know that out of 400,000 Maltese inhabitants, it is estimated that 13,000 are immigrants, generally from the wider Mediterranean basin, from the Middle East, from Northern Africa, people from different cultures and different religions. What is the lessons that the Maltese Church is learning from this experience?
Well, I think that the first thing is that we have to preach what is, I think, of fundamental importance in the Word of God, that everybody, whatever his race, his religion, his skin color, is made to the image of God. And so the other things are secondary, whatever. And we're trying to put that message across so that I don't think that fundamentally the Maltese people are racist. But because we had great numbers of immigrants coming over to Malta, there is a kind of fear that some kind of racism would arise in the island. So we're trying to put that message across. The second is that the church is itself helping. There are about 400 of the immigrant families. Now I'm speaking about those who came by boat, because in the island there are also a number of immigrants who have come from, let's say, especially from over Europe. And obviously they are not so seen because they're the same color as we are. But since the people that came from Northern Africa and from even further south in Africa, because they have a different skin color, they are more visible. But with all these, the church is trying to help. The church has great respect for everybody and tries to help as much as it can.
Finally, can you please describe for us, if possible, the atmosphere that we can breathe in these days in Malta?
I think there is great expectation on the major part, on the main part of this, the people of the island. Obviously, there has been also some, and we have to say it, that even the local media, not everybody has been, let's say, gentle towards this visit. But on the whole, the Maltese people is waiting for the Pope with great expectation, with great love, with great expectation for his word and for his message. He will have a very warm and loving and faithful welcome on this island.
That was Archbishop Paul Cremona talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. As we heard earlier, a major new issue facing Malta over the past decade has been the arrival on its shores of thousands of illegal immigrants, mostly from Africa and the Middle East. Most land on Malta by mistake, whilst trying to cross the sea to Italy from Libya in often rickety and desperately overcrowded boats. Almost without exception, those migrants who land in Malta are held behind lock and key for several months in grim detention centres while their status is determined. Father Joseph Cassar is the head of the Jesuit Refugee Services in Malta that is at the forefront of trying to provide advice and assistance to migrants and help ease their integration into Maltese society. I began by asking Father Joseph what message the Maltese people were hoping to hear from the Pope during this weekend visit.
I would say there are two different sets of messages. On the one hand, all committed Catholics would want to be confirmed in the faith, and that is why they would be looking forward to the Pope's visit this weekend. They would want words of encouragement, they would want words of hope, but also words which show that the Christian faith is still very relevant in today's world. Obviously, on the other hand, the whole argument of abuse cannot be asserted. And I would say that there are a lot of people who are waiting for some word expressing apology, which applies also to the local scene, has made an apology. The bishops here have also made an apology.
What kind of reaction and feedback was there to that apology by the bishops ahead of this papal visit?
Well, that has come rather late in the day, and only just a couple of days ago. Some people received it positively, but those concerned have expressed regret that they had not yet been met by the bishops. Say that they are not interested in compensation or anything of the sort, but in having the possibility to discuss with the highest authorities in the church their suffering over the years.
Malta is a small and very densely populated island, and surveys show that many of the Maltese people harbour xenophobic views and fears about this influx of illegal immigrants landing on the island's shores. So just how much hostility is there among the local population towards these migrants? Father Joseph again.
I would say the hostility rises and falls according to the number of arrivals. So if the number of new arrivals of boat people were to go up again, then more of the hostility would come to the fore. For as long as people, newer arrivals would not be coming, then the hostility is somewhat abated. But otherwise, I believe it is only dormant. It is unfortunately very present and very there.
And how does this hostility manifest itself? Give me some examples.
Well, for example, example, a lot of African migrants would complain of being in many ways either harassed or else discriminated against, or perhaps given weird looks or remarks would be passed in their presence in various situations. So this could be anywhere from boarding a bus to accessing a public service. Unfortunately, it shouldn't be that way, to going to a place of entertainment, but also generally even in other situations. The trouble is that, of course, people are regarded with a rather negative perception, given that all boat migrants, who are generally asylum seekers, nearly everybody without exception applies for asylum, everybody is put in detention as the first means of reception. Therefore, the whole system of detention criminalizes migrants in the minds of people. So the reaction is generally hostile and very unlike what St. Paul, which the Pope's visit is meant to commemorate, what St. Paul's visit to Malta and the initial misgivings as recounted in the Acts of the Apostles, then turning to hospitality, that is now turned on its head.
I was speaking to Father Joseph Cassar of Jesuit Refugee Services in Malta. It's a question that understandably looms large in every parent's mind. How safe are my children from the kind of clerical sex abuse that we've heard so much about in the media in recent weeks and months? But amidst all the anger and pain over the revelations about the extent of clerical sex abuse over the past decades and the mishandling of the issue by the Catholic hierarchy, it's often overlooked that in the last few years, concrete measures have been taken by the church authorities in many countries to safeguard children and vulnerable adults within the church. In England and Wales, a series of reviews of safeguarding arrangements, along with the adoption of more robust policies and procedures, have been put in place since 2001 with this precise aim in mind. Bill Kilgallen is the head of the National Catholic Safeguarding Commission. It's an independent body that sets the strategic direction of the Church's safeguarding policies for children and vulnerable adults. The Commission is also responsible for monitoring compliance with these policies. Kilgallen believes the Catholic Church in England and Wales has learned from its past mistakes, and he says he's confident about the effectiveness of the structures now in place to protect the vulnerable.
In my view, the procedures are very robust and thorough. What we have is a structure which has representatives at parish level in every parish across the country. These are volunteers who work in the parish to make sure that every reasonable precaution is taken to make sure that those who work with children and vulnerable adults are suitable people. In each diocese, we have an independent commission which is chaired by somebody from outside the church, a person with experience in safeguarding or in the police or in the law, and a group of people working with them. That commission makes sure that within the diocese, the national guidelines are followed. Each diocese then has a person working as a coordinator or safeguarding officer. In the bigger diocese, perhaps two or three people. And then nationally, we have the commission, which I chair, which is an independent body, setting the policies and monitoring the compliance with those policies. And we've also brought the religious congregations into this, and they have four regional commissions which work in a similar way.
So are all cases of alleged abuse reported automatically to the civil authorities? Is there in effect a zero tolerance policy like in the US?
Yes, the guidelines in England and Wales are that as soon as there is an allegation or a concern, this is reported to the civil authorities. That will be either the police or the local authority responsible for safeguarding adults and children, or both at the same time, depending on the nature of the case. And the church then lets that investigation take place and helps with that investigation. And then the civil authorities take their action as necessary. If, however, at the end of that investigation, the authorities decide not to prosecute, this could be for a variety of reasons. The matter doesn't end there. The church then carries out, through its safeguarding officers, an inquiry into the matters that have been raised. And it could be that those will result in action being taken by the church.
But it's very much left up to the church at this point.
Once the civil authorities have finished, yes. But the first step is always to report to the civil authorities and to assist in their investigation.
So if the church were to conclude that there are grounds, at least for doubt, concerning this person, that he would then be removed from pastoral work?
Well, yes, when the allegations made, the general practice would be to remove the person temporarily from pastoral work until the investigation was complete.
Is there, in tandem with this, a better and more rigorous screening of candidates to the priesthood and religious life?
Certainly for the diocesan priesthood, there's a much more rigorous screening. Obviously, the religious orders have introduced screening in different ways. Not all religious orders, of course, have their leadership in England and Wales, and so their standards sometimes reflect that of other countries. But we've done a lot of work on safeguarding with the seminaries, and our safeguarding staff nationally meet with the seminary rectors of England and Wales every year. We've had input into the curriculum as well as the selection of candidates, so that people coming out of seminaries are much better prepared for dealing with these issues than they were previously.
And approximately how many alleged abuse cases are reported each year? I mean, for instance, in 2008, do you have the figures?
In 2008, there were 51.
And of these cases, how many, what percentage were proved to have some substance to the allegations?
Of the 51, 13 were being investigated. In 29, no further action was taken by the statutory authorities. There were course hearings in 2, conviction in 3, and a police caution in 1. However, there was action taken by the church in respect of most of the others.
Yes.
Sorry, of those, more than half of them were related to incidents that had taken place in the 1970s. So half of them went back 30 years or more. And of those 51, 30 were clergy or religious. 7 were volunteers. 6 were people in the parish, and 5 were employees of the church.
And what kind of feedback have you got from Catholics in general on this matter? Do they ever say that they now feel safe in the church? Do they feel that it's got its house in order on this issue?
I think that there is a sense within the church in England and Wales that we have taken good steps forward. But I have to say that people in this country are very affected by the reports from other countries, and particularly, for example, from Ireland, because there's a very strong connection between the church in England and the church in Ireland. A very large number of church people in England, of Catholics in England, are of Irish descent.
Now, you yourself are a parent, and you would have no qualms whatsoever in entrusting your children, let's say talking about your grandchildren, to the church?
You know, currently I'm also a foster carer, and we have care of young children now who go to church with us, and I'm confident in the church I go to that the people who, for example, run the children's liturgy have been properly vetted, have been properly screened and recruited to do that, and have good, sensible precautions in place to make sure that children are not put at risk. We're not complacent about this, because although the numbers are small, what we do know about child abuse is that its effects are very serious for the individuals, and they last a very long time. They damage people for many years, and many people don't recover from the damage. We also know that even a few people, a small number of priests or volunteers within the church, if they abuse children or vulnerable adults, the impact of that on the parish, on the community, and on the reputation of the church is huge. And so, even though they're small numbers, one is far too many.
Now, whilst talking about that, you said earlier that the systems in place are very robust, but is there room, in your opinion, for further improvements? And if so, where and how?
The improvements we are working towards are, first of all, making sure that people use the procedures that we have, because we do have examples of where structures have been put in place to deal with individuals, and these individuals have circumvented even the guidelines that are there, because we do know that people, particularly paedophiles, are very clever at using systems and getting around restrictions placed upon them. So we have a constant need to be training people to make sure that they apply the structures and the procedures and apply them well. The second thing we're working to do more of is more work in providing support to people who have been abused, because for many of them, the fact that they were abused within the church can be a real block to their spiritual well-being, and the church needs to address that and to work with them to help people to recover from the damage that's been done to them. And then the third issue is providing, if you like, a safety net, a circle of control and support to people who are abusers and seek to practice their religion, perhaps when they've come out of prison. And so we have a system in this country of managing that with the statutory authorities, and the church is very much involved in that work of making sure that people who are known offenders are not able to get back into a position in the church where they can offend again, but at the same time having a system where they can, under proper control, be allowed to attend church.
Okay, moving on to something more in the news at the moment. A victim of sexual abuse by a jailed priest has this week accused the Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nichols, of dodging an apology over sexual abuse. Do you think this is a fair criticism?
No, I've seen the statement made by the Archbishop, or the letter made by the Archbishop, and I think he has been particularly clear in all the time that he's been involved as a bishop in these issues, being very clear and honest about the failings within the church and supporting very robust procedures to deal with it. I think the press coverage by one particular newspaper this weekend has been well below the standards that you would expect of any reasonable newspaper in covering this story.
So, to sum up, you feel confident that the church has learnt from its mistakes of the past and that there would never be now the risk that a culture of secrecy or lack of transparency could prevail when it comes to reported abuse cases, never be the temptation to shove them under the carpet, as it were?
No, I don't think there would be that temptation anymore. You know, we set these procedures up some years ago, and they arose because the church had got it wrong previously. So we're not in England and Wales in any way saying to any other country, we're better at this than you, or we don't have the problems that you have. They came to light a bit earlier in England and Wales than in some other countries. And so it's from that experience that we've built up these structures. We're saying we've had our problems, we're facing up to them, and that transparency and working together with the civil authorities is absolutely essential in all of this. And the one thing I will say is that we have had, in our safeguarding work, tremendous support from the statutory authorities in this country. In every diocese, the commissions, the independent commissions, have representatives of the statutory authorities on them. All doing is on a voluntary basis for the protection of children and adults. So we've had really positive relationships with the statutory authorities.
I was speaking to Bill Kilgallen, head of the National Catholic Safeguarding Commission. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Hodges. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, and you can check out our website at any time on www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.